I classes in high school in Portland. And word spread, and before after long, every high school that was then about 14 or 15 in Portland had classes in the Edward. And see, I had such a miserable time as a child because I loved letters from the time I was five, and nobody could show me how to make them, although I had a wonderful penmanship teacher, a man I loved, but he was an old-style Thomas Edward Watson's conservative man, and I didn't like the letters. So I was always looking for some right way, and when I found Johnson, that took me by. But I decided that I didn't want any child in the Portland High School to go through the agony that I went through when I was in elementary school, high school, and college, trying to design letters. Because I found myself always on the art staff that I looked for, and was often the art editor of student publications, both in high school and in college. So I wanted to know how. And it wasn't until after I was released in about 1934 that I found Edward Johnson. And he gave me such a boost, I'll never forget the May afternoon when I opened the book and read a few pages and felt like knocking myself in the head with a hammer because it was so obvious what one had to do. Because Goethe and William Morris both sort of directed me to it. He says, study the alphabet historically. Learn to cut a reed pen and write your way through the history of the alphabet, and then you'll know what a letter is. Well, of course, but it didn't matter. Why couldn't I understand that before? So for years I did that. I spent all the time I could with books of bibliography and reproductions of old manuscripts and tried to arrange them chronologically and see how one letter form changed into another letter form, how one alphabet changed into another, because they are not absolutely arbitrary in their changes. Now, of course, an alphabet is arbitrary in that there are no alphabets in nature. They're purely a human invention. But once the Semites started writing the proto-alphabet in 1500 B.C., then certain orderly things began to happen, more or less orderly. And it's fascinating to see how they happened. Well, these teachers were interested in finding out about what the alphabet really is, and I encouraged them to get the students to use it in handwriting, use the italic, not just formal Sunday writing, which always looks stiff and self-conscious, and has no rhythm, or feeling of music to it. But to get into the handwriting, because I'm convinced that unless a person has a nice daily handwriting with the edge pen, or even to the point that he's not going to be able to do formal work, but isn't dead. He's self-conscious of it. Because your personal rhythm in your handwriting, once you learn it, and learn it so well that you can write it with your eyes shut, which shows it's in your fist then. Once it's in your hand, you can write with your eyes shut, obviously. You can all sign your name with your eyes shut, and they look pretty good. But you see, you've done it too. But once a person gets that, then you'll be able to go ahead and kick that upstairs into his formal work. Well, the teachers said in time it was an all-important school. At first it was only a couple of weeks, and what, to my horror, they called an art experience. You can't have an art experience in 2 weeks. You can't have it in anything short of a couple of years, actually. Well, the students had it for a couple of weeks. They wanted 6 weeks out of it. Then the teacher was excited because the students were that interested. Then they wanted a term. Then they wanted a year. And the principal began to get suspicious in the school. Then when the kids wanted 2 years of pen work and calligraphy, the principal was sure something bad was going on. He couldn't understand that at all. In a period when students are said that they won't read, they won't write, I should think that he would have been so excited to find a student reading and writing with the italic that he would have called the newspapers and the television stations. But principals, they're strange people. For one thing, introducing this pen work into the schools wasn't their idea. And I think that must bother them, so they try not to to see that very much is made out of it. When the students want a second year, and I know this happened in two high schools in the Portland area, when the students demanded a second year of the calligraphy, the principal said, if you get 10 students, it's a miracle. Two in each school is on 250 signed up. So students get fascinated with it. And I found after a while that the students that did get down to a small handwriting, that they improved in all their work. I kept hearing from teachers all the time. I'd hear from parents. And I've had parents call me up regarding their elementary school kids who wanted to drop out of school. Boys who would cry and they wouldn't go back to school. I became convinced that it was because of the Palmer Kirshner Wooster handwriting that it was forced on them in the third grade. They couldn't understand it and they couldn't handle it. So we found that this seemed to help greatly in the morale and in the studies in all fields. The kids would be praised, and many of these boys would be troublemakers, full of energy, and knowing what to do with it. They heard about on the athletic field and how to bang one another around, and they think that somehow or other is the answer to getting rid of that excess energy. But they want more than that. They do want the skill. But when their papers are handed around in the school and they're praised, they begin to think maybe they're not such hopeless slobs after all. And they begin to think they can do something else. And it's amazing how many stories I've heard from teachers and parents about how a decent handwriting seemed to change the student's attitude towards school altogether. I've had parents tell me that their children learned to hate school in the third grade because of the commercial cursive handwriting. Now, at least after my lecture, they said they recognized that that was what did it, because the children would complain constantly of these ridiculous letter forms. In the first and second grade, the child gets good letters like that. But it's cheap. Now, it can hardly tell these apart. As a small child, he thinks, now why did they make it so hard? This is Pendennis. He's a good guy. He got out of the age. He got out the age of his friend and his mother. He got out the age of his dog. It got worse. Well, what do you do with that? And they would get, in the first and second grades, they'd get designs like that, which are nice. They're used. And then they get in the third grade. Well, no wonder they think adults are dopes. There's a couple of nine-year-olds in the Lincoln lot, that's my house, right outside of my studio. I heard them talking one day, and they said that grown-ups are dopes. Don't trust nobody over nine. This happened. They're too close to being adults, and therefore they're not being trusted at all. But anyone who will impose that transition on a child, that's is just being sadistic altogether. And that's happening all over America. But Oregon, several years ago, because of the work of the new teacher that friend, has adopted the town as an optional system of handwriting, official for all Oregon schools. The reason they haven't made it the handwriting, I think, is that we can't get the teachers trained. I mean, in Portland, about 18 years ago, the superintendent of curriculum invited me to come over and talk with him about italic. And we had three sessions, 3 different weeks. When I got through, he said, Hey, that looks like an awfully good system. We'll start it next fall. And he fell off the chair. Did you say you were going to start it next fall? He said, well, yeah, is that all right? And I said, how many teachers are there? Isn't it close to 3,000? He said, yeah. But how are you going to train them? Oh, my God, he said, do they need training? He thought that you issued an email from the superintendent's office on Friday, and over the weekend, the teachers would all read some stuff on Metallic and start teaching it the next week. It sounded that silly. As if he said, Friday, over the weekend, I want you all to buy violins and practice them, and the next weekend, we'll take to church. You take that much understanding. Americans have just about that much understanding of what's involved in the arts. You don't realize that there are mysteries and doubts, and that you have to grow into them slowly, that you have to change your personality to some degree to get out of it. Well, teachers don't know what part of that is. I asked my teachers over and over again, how much is a cube? I didn't understand what such to me as a cube at all. And anymore, I couldn't find out where the R was, where the G was in that letter. And then I found out through study over the years that it's an unctuous G, which is this. The rest of it all flourish. The G is there. Here, there's the S. The rest of it is all meaningless, empty flourish. Businessmen like to be elegant. They're crude and businesslike. And they're suspicious of them, but they're often very cultured and elegant and refined. So they doctor up the handwriting so that it looks like a Midwest costume. And of course, it doesn't work. It doesn't work very well, anyhow. When the Parmesaner Grocery Reform came around 1900, what they did in their ignorance was to take a Spencerian ham and then cut all the extraneous things out of it, as if you could make an honest woman with May West with a pair of scissors. She's not going to come out of them tonight. I think that a good handwriting under Italic is simple, plain forward Italic, is as simple as Shaker furniture, which I think is the most beautiful design, the most beautiful making that's been done in America by the immigrants. I can't compare it with the elegance of the Native Indian work, but of all the things that the immigrants of America produced, to me, Shaker furniture is the most sophisticated and the most elegant of all work. And by the way, it was done without Simon. Nobody gave his name to any of the pieces. They were all done for the glory of God. And the eagle got out of it. And they became the finest craftsmen we had, I think. Well, that kind of simplicity and functionalism is what we want. Not the functionalism of a nut bowl, but the functionalism of the Grecian urn. And the Grecian vases were all extremely functional. Each one was designed precisely for its use. And we can have that kind of elegance. Well, training the sequence is our biggest headache. I think we're never going to get very far with this reform, although it's taking place all over. In Alaska, the first and second grades are running the Metallic. In the 52 Anchorage school districts, they're all changing over. And what a wonderful place it is. I've done a little teaching up there in the summer. I set the alarm for 6, and I wake up and look out the window, and the sun's right up here. God, I hope it's that. It must be at least 10 o'clock. What do I do? They didn't have a phone. Why didn't they phone? And I look at my watch, 6 o'clock. I run around the house looking at all the clocks in the apartment, and I'll say 6 o'clock. And then, of course, during the winter, the sun comes up about 11:45 and sets about 11:45. I mean, I shouldn't get into this, but I'm really proud M. Torres travels in Desert Arabia a few days ago. That the film, Men Who Dare, reminded me of what a wonderful book that was. I've read it for years. He tells about trying to explain to these Arab tribesmen about the Laplanders and how in Laplanders the sun would be up practically in time, 24 hours except around midnight for half an hour or so, and in the winter it wouldn't come up until about noon and would go down immediately. And the Arabs couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe there could be such a crazy country, and then how could anyone stand to live in it? They said, when do they know, how do they know when to pray? And I said, this is a Muslim country, you pray at sunup, you pray at noon, you pray at sundown. The sun comes up 10 or 12, and you don't stand up to that. There's no sense at all. So, teachers, we're never going to get where we want to get until the colleges of education have courses, let's say 2-year courses in pen work, and involving the study of the history of the alphabet. It would take that long, I think, if we get enough skill to teach it. That will be commercial work. 2 years. And one of the things they teach is what the letters are, how they evolved. Now, we can't get into the beginning, this incredible invention of the Semites in around 1500 B.C. This would just take too long. But they were the first and only people to invent an alphabet. And when Hitler wanted to get rid of Schwabacher and Fraktur because he said a Jew had invented them, he didn't know that if you were consistent, you'd have to get rid of a whole alphabet because it was Semitic. And so, that's a long story. The thing happened in 1941. The teachers should learn about how letters develop. And I said they developed according to a dialectic. The eye and the hand are contraries. And the Hegelian dialectic, you have thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. In the change it goes on. You know, not only the Chinese and the Egyptians been interested in change, the rest have been interested in the nature of change for a long time. So the I, as in, provides the thesis. The hand provides the antithesis. Now what follows in time is the synthesis. The Marxists are overdoing the concept of the conflict between them, and for most Marxists it's just crunch. You need a crunch, so that's the basis for theories of evolution. But it needn't always be crunch any more than yin and yang need inevitably constant crunch and violence. So this, the I, is yang. And the hand is yin. Now, if the I dominated completely, we'd still be writing an early Semitic script. If the I had all of faith, given, power. We don't like that. We have quite different alphabets. So that the hand has ever lived. The eye would like to preserve everything. The eye is a conservationist. It wants to maintain the status quo. The eye is analytically rational. The hand, whatever has the tradition, The head wants to innovate. It wants to invent. It wants to have fun. It wants to play. And the eye is kind of grim and no happy business, please. So, let's start with Roman history with the Capitolus Quadratus. Now, the stone cut inscriptions, they became somewhat more formal when they were cut in stone. This was done by the library with reed pens on papyrus, later with quills on parchment. The alphabet of capitals was perfected in Rome before the beginning of the Christian era, but finally had its best perfection, best forms, about 112 by AD 112 in the Trajan inscription. Now, they had a very informal hand, which you see in the Pompeii at its best, because it looks as if it had been done just a day or so before. Some of them are very fresh. They were buried since 112 AD under the ashes of the eruption of Pompeii, and unearthed, they're incredibly fresh. And it's wonderful to watch. This was a rapid cursive alphabet, but notice that the hand has omitted the crossbar and is extending in the center. Now, in the so-called Christian alphabet, which came next, the eye apparently said, look, we need that crossbar. And the hand said, oh, we don't need it that much. I have to lift and go over there to put that in horizontal. The eye said, how can I just cut across lots? The eye said, oh, that's sloppy. And the hand said, no, I'm not going to lift and go up there and make that horizontal. I'm going to cut across lots. Finally, the eye gave in. So that was the, this is rustic, this is unsure. They happened, they're going out almost at the same time. Now, considerably later, the hand does another thing. Yin is just crazy. It does wonderful things, but it keeps wanting to simplify and improve, and that's fun out of it. The hand does it by angles often. So the hand rounded that angle. And I'm skipping certain stages in there. I produced that by rounding this. Now notice when I wrote that, it was 1, 2, 3. And please, you teachers, teach it that way. The right side does not come second in the crossbar third. Because here it is, 1, 2. This follows 1 immediately. And this is the last stroke. This hairline in here is that crossbar. This is the left side of it. This is the right side of it. Now, you know that was cat. As a way of writing this part first, because the early humanists in their cursive made that A. In other words, the hand stayed on the paper. Another Yin tendency was to stay on the paper, but it cut off this curve. So you have the left side of A, the crossbar, and the right side. And then the eye said, please, let's have a little more dignity in the hand. Stand up on the right side. So the hand finally said, and yes, and stood it up. But this is the important part of it down here. So when it was made cursive, it kept only the ball. So here is the left side of it, the crossbar, and the right side. Well, what's this? And I have books published by publishers who are trying to promote commercial cursing, and I can't tell the difference between the A's and the O's, except by reading the words. The A and the O will be written identical. Now, if you cannot distinguish quickly between two letters in the alphabet, it's a bad alphabet. And you need to throw it out. Yet that's what children will learn today. Like if they read California or Colorado, was persuaded. The poor madman doesn't know which stick that means. I was there. No, Missouri or Massachusetts. So it doesn't look good on an address on an envelope if you can't tell where to really know the way. You have to read the zip code. Well, I can't go into very many other letters, but you can imagine a cat B. They just left off the upper hole. That's the location of the handle made. It will be in the upper part. Then the C, they kept the thing the same way. D, remember D had originally been a delta. It was a door. Left the door in the saloon. From this turned into a socket up above, and this is the socket below, a swinging door. And then it got simplified to this. By the time it got to the Greeks, they didn't know what it was. They do it that way. They didn't know the Dalton door. So they called it Delta. At the river mouth, the deposit of silver, the river mouth, is named after the letter. The letter isn't named after the Delta. But the Romans stood it up. The eye apparently said, everything is just going every which direction. Can't we get a little stability? They can't get things stand up. This he was very straight, you know, all the time. But the hand said, now that's just too green. Let's round this. Okay, I said, rather standing it up, I guess I can take the rounding. So they come to choose, you see. There's a synthesis out of yin and yang opposites. Then when they started writing it rapidly, the hand starts going extruder up again as we do it on A. But the hand rounds corners. So they rounded that corner. Then the eye says, oh, come on, hand. That is silly. Can't we stand it up? So the hand says, okay, if you insist. And it's turned it up. Now it's all those moves from the right side around to the left side. And it's done it entirely through this dialectic of yin and yang, contraries, which are not negations of Greek sense, but they cooperate and they work together. I think it's very close to the same that happens in the I Ching, where you find typical moments in the development of change where you can look at a hexagram and say, here's a typical important moment in the change of this continuous relationship between the yin and yang. So an alphabet is, in a way, a hexagram, not having the same meaning, however, but it is the result of the synthesis of contraries. E, you could do E for me now, probably just by yourself. Because the hand is going to run. Yeah, did this first, then this, and last do this. So we do the left side of the E, we do the top, and then we have the mid bar. So the hand is now around in the animals. Later, I'm giving off certain stages. This is going to connect with that. But here is an angle. And by the way, the hand in a hurry tends to slope, so it sloped, and here we have the talon key. And then, in commercial fiction, you get this end of the cell, you would show me an ice cream. But nearly every handwriting letter written in commercial cursive that I hear, all these are eyes without the dots. Can't be an E. This is an E, and a two-stroke E is going to remain legible. And when you join out of the two-stroke E, you join out of that, and that join is that mid-bar. Does that make sense? Well, there are more of them, just a few more, than of E-F-G-H. Oh, G is one of my favorites. The original square cap G, which oh, the story of G is wonderful, but I won't go into it. It's the only letter the Romans invented. All their other letters were based on letters borrowed from the Greeks, because the Greeks borrowed more of them from Phoenicians. But the hand rounded that, rounded this angle and rounded that angle. But it looks like a seam that likes to look like a crescent. It's not a good G. So in the so-called Christian alphabet, the unction, the I insisted on returning to vertical. But the hand likes to slope, so the I finally made truce with the hand and said, since you've given me the vertical back, all right, I'll let you have the slope on it. But the hand after a while gets sort of funny. and puts a curve where the angle lies. But the hand doesn't remember, and the eye apparently gets careless unless the hand do that. Then you get the Anglo-Irish half inch. Now, that letter begins to get flourishes. The hand wants to flourish. So we get that. And I'll leave out a couple of stages, a longer black letter stage like this. But the hand rounds this angle. And then when you want to see that took, then that might take several strokes. I did it in three. But if you want to write it in one stroke, and the hand is always in a hurry, he straightened out a lot of these curves and gave us that. But today, he seems to be listening to Jesus. But all the beauty of it is gone. And the string that is commercial cursive has lost all its grace and beauty. So I'd say if the teacher would explain this sort of thing to students, there'd be... By the way, I find kids are fascinated with it. I'll talk to 6th and 7th graders in the elementary school. They don't want me to stop. They want to know more and more about it. That Q's a lovely letter. Originally, it was a piece of string. Cough was this. A knot with a piece of string hanging out from it. Then it gets that beautiful shape. But in the cursive form, it gets to be that. However, before it became that, it was... And unsure this. You see what happened? The hand is in a hurry and doesn't want to go to the left and then back to the right. So it cut across lots the way everybody does. The sidewalk goes this way, they're always taking the diagonals. They're in a hurry. Human beings are very impatient. So they cut across the lawn, even though a sign says stay off the grass. They cut across the grass. But the guy said, now, wouldn't it look nicer if we had a string up there? So we get that. And the curve shaved back into the straight, drew Yang's wanting a little more semblance of order. But now, this is a graceful, cursive, quick letter for the cube. Now notice if this loop up here would have been smaller, and then you turn the loop into this down here, wow, there's a commercial cursive Q, so that's what it was up to. And I know for years I asked teachers, well, how's that a Q? Well, I don't know, it just is a Q, we don't copy it. By the way, go back to that D. I think that is the most ugly graphic design in the history of the graphic art. I only had chairs in school, the third, fourth, fifth grade. I never could make that deep. I never could make it ugly enough. Yet, the teacher insisted on this loop, on that broken spine, and this loop up here. And what does it have to do with Dean? Why can't it just be an honest, early letter like that? The kind that they get in Princeton in first and second grade. It's a nice letter. This is an utter imbecility. And yet children have to practice this. And you can't tell me that this is faster than this. This cannot be. It is faster the way I get it on letters because I can't tell what it is when I see it on paper. It's broken down completely. And it's just a R is not interesting enough. S isn't until you get to the law and S. The Romans wore on wax tablets. And any curve would tear up wax, so they couldn't make curves and they big straight lines, so that what had been a lovely letter became that. Just those straight lines. Finally, they just said, oh, heck with it, and they straightened this out completely, forgot this, and just left that. Then they, on papyrus, they joined into it. E would go into S that way. So the joined into S in the 6th century became part of the letter. And that became S. So in old books today, you may see that as S. You can find it in calculus where S the sign means take the sum of the differential. It's similar. And it is an old-fashioned, elongated S. I think it's a beautiful letter. I wish we still had it, because it's very hard to make two S's look just alike. And you put two S's together like that, and you get a beautiful shape again. A beautiful abstract shape. So politically, we wish we had that long S again. But it complicated the type cases way, way too much, because there were many literatures. S-T, S-H, S-K, and so on. So they to simplify the type case, they got rid of it. In commercial cursive, Z is this way, and italic is this way as a rule. Although, depending on the design, I may use that. Depending entirely on the design, but this is the accepted italic Z. Now, where did that loop come from? For a long time, in the southern part of Europe, it was customary in the Middle Ages to make a monogram out of old R. It was this R without the vertical, you see. They used the right side of the O for the vertical. And then for the V in the rondo, after V, they use this R. Well, they got used to it, and finally, they used this alone as R. But if you roll it rapidly, it looked like a Z. Or a Z were written and got an angle in it that looked like an R. So the difference between Z and R is this for the Z. But we don't need that now, since our R is just the beginning. It's just the beginning of this R. And you go over here and then you stop. And the hand omits all the letter. D is just a rounded U. Or U is just a rounded U. It's the same letter up until around 1526. They considered it the same letter. It didn't have, you call everybody in here calls that a U sometimes. Are you guilty? You call it U when you have this. There was stuff called U, the Queen Elizabeth State, so it stopped in the government and called it both a U. So it's an old letter. That one of the weird things, I shouldn't get into, I don't want to get into that. Too much of it, there's no stopping it. I wish I could talk about elements of space in regard to design, but maybe that'd be a better way than the class is getting too late. The important thing in the writing, which is interesting to know, is that there's very little ink in the letter. and very little ink in the Word. But the Word is not just ink. See, in our materialistic thinking, we think that the ink is a form, and the form just inhabits empty space, and the space doesn't mean anything. So we put letters into space. We don't. Letters are space, and there is more white paper on a page of printing and of writing than there is ink. In fact, there's only a couple of percent of the page has ink on it. It's almost all white paper. You look at it sometime and see. You can shove all that ink down into a little big corner on the page and give up that big square. It's almost all white paper. We read the white paper. It takes more white paper to make a letter than it does ink. If you doubt it, look in an ink bottle and tell me how many letters you see. You see, you can't find any letters because there's no paper there. So design is designing white paper at the same time that you're designing a blank ink. You're doing a double job. So you have to look at the paper and look at the ink. Design means being intensely conscious of the continuum. And oh boy, does that get into theology and metaphysics. The reality is a continuum, and all things are interrelated. The valley is just as important as the mountain. Otherwise, you have Eastern or Northern Texas. You'd have a wheat field in Kansas or Nebraska. It would be like South Dakota. It's so exciting to get there. Disappointing because there are no mountains, but I always feel that I'm at the beach because the horizon is way down there, it seems. Part of the rest of the horizon is up. The mountains are all up there. But here you feel as if you're on a mountain all the time because everything is so low. It's all sky. Just like a pool table. How high are the mountains there? Because there ain't no valleys. That's why there goes. It takes a valley to make a mountain. Gertrude Stein would be a remarkable genius. Oh, what a wonderful woman that crazy woman. She says, a mountain peak is surrounded by its distances. Oh, gee, what an observation. That's a threat. Yeah, the mountain peak is almost entirely distances. Without it, again, it would be a Kansas wheat field. So, it is untouched paper that is largely responsible for the paper. So, students watch the paper. They're learning. Watch the paper as much as they watch the ink, watch the pen. And they're getting the sensation of making the letter, they're getting the sensation of designing white colors. There are no voids in art, unless you say that all parts of art are void. It's all void, or it's all real. Oh. Seem to be real. Because the white paper is a thing and has a shape, and this is the ink. So it's a continuum. And you have to accept the continuum, or you go back into the complete void and nothing distinguishes from anything else. The whole universe is a black hole. Which it will when Brahma gets tired enough and goes to sleep again, but there's still quite a while to go before Kali Yuga is over with. But if you have questions, we'll try to get into some of these things involving touch and movement and form in the next 2 days. Well, that's just a discussion. Good.
What about the left-handed person?
The left-handed person. He's one of the persecuted in the Lord. The left-handed are white. Only the right-handed people were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. And therefore, respectable. The problem in writing left-handed is that I haven't stressed this, but the most important thing is the idea to get when you're starting to write is that you have to control that angle, that edge. This is so wonderful. The edge is almost non-existent, and yet that's the reason for having the pen, is an edge which is practically non-existent. It's just where one plane meets another. All the rest of it is just for the sake of hanging on to it or hoping it ain't. The edge does all the work. So you have to concentrate intensely on the edge and the angle that the edge makes and feel the difference in friction between one kind of stroke and another kind of stroke and a curve, because the vibration of the pen, the sensation of touch will tell you where you are on the curve, what sort of line you're making. Now, the left hand of the curve, right? You've got to get this edge of the 45-degree angle. How can you do it? This is in the way. And you will see the alphabet was designed by right-handed people for right-handed people. You've got a kind of big hole out here. It's your digestion to cut all this out. You can't get the hand over. Now, the left-handed students who are teachers say there's only one way to do it. Turn the paper 90 degrees, and then the elbow doesn't have to get into the side at all. Can you see it up here at all? You. Now, I'm not left-handed.
Doesn't that make you dizzy?
Vertically, the paper turned off this 90 degrees. But if you see right-handed doing this all the time, I do. Well, what's wrong with turning it the other way? Writing down here instead of up here. It's no more unnatural for the left-hander to be writing from top to bottom than it is for the right-hander to be writing from top to bottom, from bottom to top. And they'll see them very often do it. So, I say a lefty should work in whatever way he can. If I was teaching small children, by the way, you don't use an edge in small children. They just use a point. And you can get beautiful writing with a point. But it's bones. The beautiful, beautiful bones of the tongue. And I like flesh and blood better than bones alone, so I like the edge. But the small children don't have to worry about it. And it's easy for a left-hander to write without the edge. You can write with a pencil, a ballpoint pen, or a felt-tip pen, and have practically no trouble at all. It's the edge that makes all the problem. By the way, I wouldn't have children in the school writing with the edge, possibly until the fourth grade, and then I'd say make it a reward for the excellence. Have them use the edge pen as a reward for excellence, not as something required. It's becoming almost impossible to buy fountain pens anymore because girls don't handle them. They have ballpoints and felt tips. The best pen we have today is the Schaefer American-made pen that one grinds himself. And I teach teachers to grind pens for their own use, and they grind pens for their classes. But 18 years ago, the Schaefer Pen Company asked me to, they just said, why are we selling so many Schaefer pens in Portland? We sell more Schaefer pens in Portland than any other place in the country. They told him to come out and see me. And he found out that I was cutting the end of the nib off and grinding it down and then fading. He thought they'd engineered a perfect pen, and here I was ruining the chip on it. Well, after it cooled down a bit, I said, well, we're using them because we can make a beautiful pen out of it. The ink flow is far better than in any other pen, and the cost only 90 cents at the time. Now it's $1.35, not $1.40. But it has better flow ink than any of the British pens which are made for metallic writing. So we run them ourselves. I was doing this 30 years ago. Well, he said, would you grind about a dozen nicks for us to examine? I did, and then I never heard from him. And apparently the board decided there wasn't sale enough because it would need changing the machinery. Then I was asked again about 12 years after that, and I ground about 15 nicks, all various ways, one way that we grind them, and then a way a machine might grind them, and two ways machines might grind pens of various sizes. But again, I heard nothing. And I've had lunch with the, and dinner with the president of the Schaefer Company, and he's very much interested. He'd like to do it, but I think it's his board, or more likely, the French company that owns Schaefer. And of course, the Frenchmen know nothing about the Italic handwriting movement, and about the problem of handwriting in America, so, or how popular calligraphy is becoming. A salesman from the Hunt Pen Company told the manager of the art supply store that I visited last week that all over America, the fastest growing art and craft is calligraphy at the present time. It is the most popular of the fastest growing. One nice thing about it is that it's so expensive. People spend thousands of dollars on carved wheels and ceramics and kilns, clays, glazes and so on, and only a few cents can get you started on calligraphy. A bottle of ink or coloring fluid and a popsicle stick, and you can make beautiful letters. It's just a stick of any kind, a tongue depressor. Some of my people use tongue depressors even away, and they have many dollars worth of expensive pens and use them for certain parts of the job. So it's growing. And it's fascinating and has no limit. You always think you get to the top of the mountain and then there are more ranges up above. You get there and more ranges up above. That's the lovely thing about it, you never get through. There's always more than the first. Roy, I have the names and addresses of about 18 telegraphic societies in the United States. I've heard that there are close to 30. I heard last week of a new one in Pittsburgh, two in Indiana. Indianapolis has one, and there's another in southern Indiana, and one of them formed recently in Chicago, Washington, D.C., probably all over. I did 20 lessons on metallic, half-hour programs for television about 9 years ago now, and it proved very popular, and I refilmed it a year ago this summer in color. It is the series, there's commonly both the old series and the new series, is being broadcast about the 22nd time in Oregon and Southern Washington. That is all 20 programs, over 22 times. It's being broadcast in Long Island right now, and I get letters from people in Queens, and then some places near the Bronx. No, near Brooklyn. So we hope to be able to get it into New York City before very long. I don't get anything by it, but I love to see its frame. And I understand Alaska's trying to get a copy of it. So the television programs have done an awful lot for the promotion of the movement because by seeing them over and over again, more and more parents get books and they want to take classes. But we have classes all over the state. There are about a dozen calligraphic societies in Oregon, no separate ones, but in all these little towns. Regularly, they have big meetings once a month, and they have classes going on all the time, bringing people in from all over the Northwest, some from outside the West Coast, to give weekend classes. They're crazy over there. And one reason it's happened is that having taught high school teachers and then elementary school teachers for 35 years, people see it every place and take it for granted. There's another way of doing letters, another way of handwriting. Nothing peculiar. When I got shouted, they'd say, hey, what's that rewriting? You know, meaning new college writing, not new college writing. But after a while, they don't think of it as connected with either the art museum or any particular group. It's just another way of writing, because you see it on the windows of the filling stations, the windows of the drugstores, the windows of the restaurants. You see it in many of the shops all over. So thank heavens I've become used to it. I'm not afraid of it anymore. I had a letter from Eden saying, hey, I understand you even have it in Chinatown. Somebody has sent out the Fairbank clipping in the Chinese language newspaper and in the ads here in the display lines in the tower, done by some Washington high school kids whose parents were Japanese and a small business. Well, I'm doing too much talking. Some more questions.
You talk about getting very light pressure on the pen. Mm-hmm. When you hold it, I'm holding the pen, you talk about having very light pressure. And it's just that after so many years of pressing down on the pen, is there any exercise that you know to make you lighten up? Because I know once you start writing, you're not thinking of necessarily the pressure here.
No. Well, this is the matter. I said spend a period of intense concentration on seeing how lightly you can touch the paper. I often a whole session with the college and have them write so barely goes out of the pen onto the paper and disappears on the hairline. Then as them get a little closer to the paper, and a little bit closer until they didn't get to the paper length. The handwriting first just off the paper, and then slowly getting closer until the finally begin to touch it like. See how little pressure you can use, and if the lines break, and if the hairline goes short, that's another thing. You're doing fine. You're getting a light approach to it. All right, we'll just get a little more in. Just a tiny bit, not very much. Now, don't loosen it off the clothes. Almost missing. But if you do that for a few hours, you begin to find that you might not the tension and the cramp that goes with digging into the paper. There are three dangerous pressure points. The first one is squeezing the pen too hard. The second one is pushing the pen on the paper too hard. The third one is resting the heel of the hand on the writing desk too hard. Because if you do that, it's hard to move the hand from left to right, and then the letters will crowd together, and the words will crowd together, and become illegible. The words need a lot of open space. That means the hand mustn't rest on the page very hard, just very lightly, and be able to flow along. If you can't do this and have pressure, if you write it on the paper, the hand is moving. The feel of the hand is moving on the surface of the paper. When you press down, you won't get in. I think that practicing the handwriting will help that part of the pressure. Using the handwriting, you have to touch it by the way.
Would you comment on the quality of writing the problem of maintaining quality?
Collect as many examples of beautiful writing and analyze it for them.
I think from a teaching point of view, the students have a lot of commercial work after
the class. Yeah, well, you see, they haven't made any of the progression toward these parts in the perennial pedagogy because their egos are just running everything. And they can't see their faults. But if you analyze the beautiful work and have them trace it, say, and see the difference between the awkwardly written notice, and then a beautiful one that has red on an exquisite form. It takes, their eyes have to be open, because they can't see at first. When I first came to read, I had some national students in China. They were Chinese nationals, and older than most students. And I said, what's your biggest problem in America? And they said, well, all Westerners look alike. All Westerners look alike. Well, all Italian looks alike and to a beginner, and he can't see any differences between the good work and the bad work. So I actually spend a lot of time analyzing nice work and having them trace it.
I'm thinking maybe we're not taking enough time. In the course of a 10-week class. A 10-week class.
You can't do anything.
You can't do anything. And they go out after 10 weeks and start.
What kind of a pine tree can you grow in 10 roots?
They seem to think a pretty good one.
Tell them you can only grow a squash in the summer. And the difference between a squash and a pine tree is squashes don't make very good ornamental trees, shade trees, and what we want is a good shade tree like a pine tree or an oak. And don't try to grow one in the summer. You get squashes instead. If you want a squash, or I don't grow squashes, don't do it on the paper. Yes?
Could you backtrack and
finish the 15 steps first? I'm off exactly my old issue. Tell me what you said.
Backtrack and retrace the 15 steps. Or continue. He stopped about 11, and you go on the last few steps.
The last two ones?
The last three. The last four steps.
Oh, and that's the whole verse. And I said, don't sell out. I don't have a good phrase for that. I don't have a good phrase for it. But I've heard and read about people thinking, now this is not only modern, unfortunately, thinking that art has nothing to do with morality. Therefore, because romantic artists in the left bank in France lived with their models and painted them and lived on wine and cigarettes and aspirin maybe, but that's the way to live. You do it. It's all right for an artist to do anything he wants to in his life because art has nothing to do with ethics. Now, it's easy to explain this, and Kumaraswamy does it very well. Art has nothing to do with morality. It's a good, except good or bad craftsmanship. If it's bad craftsmanship, it's not craftsmanship. The point where an artist is a human being and where ethics enters in is when he is offered a commission. Now, the commission may be a nasty one. If he accepts it, he's made an immoral choice. If it's a decent commission, he's made a moral choice. The morality comes into art the moment you decide whether to accept the commission or not. I know people who will work for any political party that will pay them to write the propaganda. And I consider them utterly immoral. I don't see how they do it. To write, if they have political opinions, to write, do the best work they can for a party they don't believe in, makes crooks out of them. They're frauds. I don't see how they live with themselves. But Kumaraswamy says if a man is hired to make a poison gas, he should make it as poisonous as he can. Because the art is to make something and then make it as well as he can do it. But if he doesn't believe in poison gas, he shouldn't accept the commission. It's a moral choice whether you're going to make a poison gas or not, or a bacteria which will wipe out the whole state in a few weeks. And there are plenty of scientists today who said science has nothing to do with art. But you know, scientists all over the world are changing their minds. They're seeing that the problem can be solved this way. Science in itself is searching for the truth. But where does the truth end? If it is put in, if their studies, the results of their studies, are put into production and pollute the environment, then they've done something that is eventually immoral. They're beginning to see what are the consequences of what I do. They're deciding whether to accept the commission or not. Because that is the moment of moral decision. So, I don't know how to phrase that here, but don't sell out with one. That is, accept only commissions that you can live with, especially when you're trying to go to sleep at night. So, did I have let it do it? Yeah. Keep to your calling, I mentioned that. I'd say become an authority. I've spoken of authority before as someone who's been there, someone who is an experienced and trained and effective mountain climber. He is an authority. Someone who can bake bread like the bread you have here at the Zen Center. Certainly if it's an authority, not bread. Anyone who has a skill can become an authority. People respect the skill and the superior quality of the skill, so he is an authority. Like an author who writes a book, he's done it himself. If the book has been ghosted for him, he's not an author. He's just provided some ideas, and then some poor hack has gone and done the work. The hack is closer to being the author. And, I say, share your knowledge. Everything we have, with no exceptions, comes from the culture we live in or the cultures which we study. Nothing is our own, really. We make it our own through work, but only in the sense that it's our own, we borrow it. And we may improve on it somewhat if we're fortunate and have grace. But the people from the beginning of history have provided us with culture. And good writing is really one aspect of the rich culture that is given to us. So that how do we pay the debt to the great people of the past who formed the alphabet and passed it on and perfected it? The only way to repay the debt we owe them is to ourselves pass it on. To share what knowledge we've gained from others. They were generous in giving us their skill, the secrets of their skill with their secrets. We can be, should be generous and pass it on too. So in a sense, I'd say we all have the responsibility of being teachers. But whether we like the idea or not, we are all teachers anyhow. Because everything we do in the presence of someone else gives them some hints as to how to act or how not to act. I'm very grateful to some of the horrible teachers I've had. I've had some terrible ones because they showed me very clearly what I could never do. I pass that negative information on. Does that add up to 15? It should.
Maybe on let, just if you had to talk about let it.
Did you have let it do it?
No, I don't think I really did that.
Let me read, this is the sequence. Get the idea as one. Two, concentrate. Three, get the feel of it. Four, take it easy. Five, practice. Six, let go. Seven, get the swing of it. Eight, be in good form. Nine, get lost in the work. 10, let it do it. 11, work for the work's sake. 12, don't sell out. 13, keep to your calling. 14, become an authority, and 15, share your knowledge. Is that okay? the perennial pedagogy. Any more questions? We're beginning to look awfully tired. Well, I hope to see you with an orange pens in hand.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask if you could help to bring some documents downstairs.
How do you mean?
Not tomorrow morning. I think it's 1:30 tomorrow afternoon, people who are going to be in the workshop.
Oh, I forgot, Jeff. It's 1:30.
What time?